The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday afternoon California time Space Show program. Thank you for tuning in. I am your host for today, David Livingston. Actually, I'm your host every day. It is great to be here. And one of my favorite topics is today on hypersonics. And I am fortunate to have actually met our guests, which I don't always get the pleasure of doing, but they were at the Space Foundation Symposium. Another reason why all of you people should be going to the Space Foundation. And the shows are much more fun and much more informative for me when I actually know the guest. But first, a couple of announcements. For those of you that would like to call and talk to our guest and ask questions about hypersonics or something that they're saying, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we do not work with call screeners, and be patient and let the phone ring, and you may stay on hold for a minute or two, but we'll bring you up on air as quickly as we possibly can. We can hold you over on the break or just delay the break, and we also answer the phone during the break. So don't let an upcoming break stop you from using the phone. Email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also post a comment or ask a question on our blog. I'll get it almost immediately. So to do that, go to thespaceshow.com. On the far right is a menu item called Upcoming Shows. This is the first show listed in upcoming shows. It is also the archive page for this program. Open it up. Comments are at the very bottom. So just comment or ask your question. And as I said, I'll get it almost immediately, and I will integrate it into our discussion. While you're at thespaceshow.com, our website, note that we have a detailed website newsletter, and I upload that after the Sunday Space Show program, so it is current for this week. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or easily download the show. By the way, on the website newsletter, if you continue to scroll down, you'll see all the programs we have listed, and we're going into the third quarter already of 2017. So check out your program guide there, and if you have suggestions for guests, do let me know. We also have a store. You'll find that in the upper left menu under support if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. In addition, there is something called Listen Live. So this tells you how to listen to a live show as well as an archive show. If you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and feel free to share that information with others who you think would find the Space Show very, very interesting. To me, the most important button is center right of the homepage, supporting the Space Show. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and we are able to bring you these programs and our content free of charge because many of you do make contributions and support the Space Show. Do remember that if you pay federal taxes, since we're a nonprofit, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you pay California taxes, you get a deduction in California as well. We are a public benefit corporation. Check out our parent 501c3 website for questions, 1-O-N-E-GiantLeapFoundation.org, or certainly feel free to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. You will also see a huge big Amazon button in the center of our homepage, and that's because Amazon has absolutely fabulous programs to support nonprofits. So if you buy books, household items, shirts, clothing, toilet paper, hubcaps for your car, whatever you buy, if you buy them through Amazon or an approved Amazon seller, they donate a portion of your purchase price to the nonprofit of your choice, which in this case is the Space Show. So there are two ways to do that, and if you click on the Amazon button in the middle of our homepage, it'll take you to our Amazon site and show you how to do that with books and anything else you buy from them. And we really appreciate those of you who use this. It does provide revenue to us, and again, thank you very, very much. It's an easy way to support the Space Show, doing what you do all the time. Please note that the Space Show is copyrighted and trademarked, and we do permit and encourage everybody to download our shows and share them with people. They're not too big a file, so you can probably email them to most people. There are a couple of rules about that. Don't do anything commercial with our programs. This is the biggie. Don't edit them. Take edits, clips, cuts, and put them on any website, including YouTube. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. So you can read our full copyright statement at the bottom of each of our website pages, as well as One Giant Leap's website page. And if you have any questions or comments, don't hesitate to ask me. The best way to get a hold of me is email drspace@thespaceshow.com. In addition to individuals supporting the Space Show, as I mentioned just a minute ago, we do have corporate sponsors, and we're deeply appreciative of their help. And they have banner ads running across our homepage. Do check out what's underneath those banner ads from time to time. They do change their content. And I do read some sponsor messages in each segment of the show for our corporate sponsors. So, for example, today, during the first segment, as usual, we have the international, the Integrated Space Plan. And this is a detailed 100-year forecast of our future in space. The plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. And you can check all of this out at their website, which is thespaceplan.com. If you look at their plan online, it's got over 500 elements in it, and they all expand to more and more information. But if you buy the full-size color poster, it is not interactive, but it is way cool, and you will want to hang it on your wall or your bedroom or someplace where it will always remind you about the potential and the value of our future in space. Also, for the first segment, the Space Foundation is our sponsor. And even though it just seems like yesterday that the 33rd Symposium ended, and as I said, that's where I met our guest, the 34th Symposium is seriously just around the corner. And you may not think April is just around the corner, but time flies really, really quickly, and it is just around the corner. April 16th through the 19th, 2018, again, Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor Hotel. The website to check it out is spacesymposium.org. Networking beyond anything you imagined, totally different people than go to an advocate conference, different content. You have to do at least one of them in your space career. So check it out for their 34th symposium. I also want to point out they have a business set of meetings coming up in San Francisco. If you're going to be in or near the Bay Area on April 30th or April 31st, it's at the Hyatt, one of the Hyatts in San Francisco. And 2 days of incredible speakers. You can find this symposium workshop on the Space Foundation website. I urge you to check it out, and if there's a way you can be there for all or part of it, do so. I will be there, as I will travel across the bridge. It's no big deal. And if you're planning to be there, email me so we can plan on meeting in person and saying hello. And that brings me to our two guests today, and I'm very happy to introduce all of you to Carl Hoos, who's the CEO and CTO of Vault Enterprises, which is a revolutionary company developing the Vault, and by the way, it's spelled V-A-L-T, launch system, specifically to address the fast-growing launch demand and space access requirements of the emerging nanosat industry. Carl has a lot of experience, and for the sake of time and maximizing our time of talking with him, I'm going to direct you to reading his bio on the website, which is there in full. Also with us today is Elise McGill, and Elise is the co-founder and the VP of Business Development at Vault Enterprises. She has extensive experience in market research and analysis, customer relationship management and organizational leadership, strategic planning, and bridging technological innovation to evolving market sector demands. Her full bio is also on the Space Show website for today's program, and you can read about Elise as well. But trust me, it is much more fun and informative to talk to both Carl and Elise. So, Carl and Elise, welcome to the Space Show. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, David.
That's Carl, and that's Elise. So you can know what they know what they sound like. Carl, introduce us to Vault and tell us a little bit about your history and what you do. And I build the show as sort of a primer on hypersonics and really innovative things. So give us the 101, okay?
Okay. Sounds good. First, I appreciate the opportunity to talk on your show. And just to get started here, I'll give you a little bit of the history where Vault came from. It was actually a spinoff of an R&D company I had, Applied Thermal Sciences, where we did a lot of work in hypersonics, scramjets, and ramjets. And it really focused on doing some low-cost flight testing for hypersonics. And that's the hypersonics. I mean, it's got a huge history to it. But the major thing, I guess, with why you don't hear too much about it is because a lot of it is focused on weapon systems now, and Vault Enterprises is on a different track, because we were really focused on access to space once NATO satellite community kind of popped up, and looking at the growth in the market, knowing that they need quicker and more, reliable access to space. So, but Vault Enterprises really came out of that need in the NATO satellite market when that popped up, and Elise was the one who kind of drug me out to Utah to show me exactly what that market was growing into, and I'm talking about the SmallSat conference. I think you've been there, David.
But, yeah, many times.
For our listeners.
Yeah, and I wish I were still going, but all of a sudden I've had some health issues the past couple of years, and now I've got speaking engagements at other conferences. So I, because of speaking, I didn't choose to go to SmallSat this year. But the last time I was there, it was about 550 people, and now it's about 1,550 people. So this has really come into its own, and that's really, really cool.
Yes, and it has. It even growed, and Elise, you might be able to correct me on this one, but I think the last year's was about 2,000, or was it 2,500 people at the SmallSat conference?
Honestly, Carl, I can't remember the exact number of attendees. I just know it skyrocketed tremendously over the last several years.
Yeah, last year was about the 1,550. I do a show every year, and actually it's coming up in 2 weeks on SmallSat with Pat. And I think it was around 1,550 last year, and they have spread out all over Utah State. And there are more hotels in the area, and it
they
is.
They need more.
Yeah, I mean, amazingly, they need more, and it is, or they need trailer space, like up in the Williston Basin of North Dakota. Maybe you can go rent a trailer for the weekend. But I have a question I want to ask you to clear up. I mean, this is probably coming to you out of left field. I've been doing hypersonic programs for years, as much as I can do with people who aren't BS artists. So I've done a few with people at Boeing that got permission to talk. But I used to do a series of people, academic folks from Australia, because Australia was being billed as the leading country for hypersonic research. And then I haven't heard Australia mentioned with hypersonics in, I don't know, 5, 7, 8 years. What happened? Or was I being misled that Australia was at the forefront of things?
I think you're right. Is, you know, a lot of the hypersonics programs are done, you know, in the back room somewhere, because of the application, at least the application that everyone's looking at now. But just this past week, the HIFIRE program, which is a joint program between Australia and the U.S. Air Force here, and it's been going on somewhere around 9 years or so.
Yeah, I did programs about High Flyer. Absolutely.
Yeah. They just had another test, and from what I've heard, it was successful, but I don't know any of the details. And it was their High Flyer 4. But High Flyer is that's really flight testing to learn a lot about the hypersonic technology. And the real key there is that you just can't simulate the flight conditions in ground test facilities. So I'll back up here a second. Hypersonics, this is one of the things that kind of makes it really a kind of, black magic kind of technology, I guess, if you will. But there's really three key design tools when you're going to develop a system. And you've got at your disposal computation of numerical tools, you've got ground test facilities, and then you have flight. And, most all the subsonic aviation, which has been going on for, years, a lot of those tools are all developed and they're well known. There's a lot of people that understand them. So when it comes to designing a new subsonic aircraft and even low supersonic aircraft, it's much easier to do those. When you start getting into the higher Mach numbers, especially when you get over Mach 4, Mach 5, and hypersonic is really defined as Mach 5 and above, that's where the ground test facilities can't really simulate exactly what you're seeing in flight for a number of different reasons. And so flight test is key. If you get flight test data, then you can correlate it with ground test data that you get, and then you can use both of those tools to help develop your models that you put in your computational simulations that you develop. But until you have that flight test data, I'm not going to say you're shooting in the dark, but you're not verifying the tools that you have and the numbers that you have. And it's not that they have to be, totally accurate. It's really key that they give you the trends in hypersonic flight for developing these systems. So that's one of the keys there in hypersonics, and we still, we have to do a lot more flight testing, and that's one of the things that High Flyer was developed to do, and University of Queensland involved in that. I know Dr. Michael Smart, who's running the program over there at University of Queensland, and I worked with him when he was at NASA Langley. We developed a combustor nozzle section for one of his, what he called a REST engine, which is the new kind of engine configuration that everyone is, I can't say everyone's looking at it, but at least the Australians are. And Michael Smart, I think that they do have a vehicle that they're looking to develop for smaller satellites to orbit, where they're using a second stage scramjet, but a little bit different than what we're doing at Vault Enterprises.
He was the guest on the space show that I interviewed several times from Queensland.
Okay.
I had forgotten his name, but yeah, that's who I talked to.
Yep. Yeah. So they're still into it, and I worked at General Applied Science Laboratories back just before the National Aerospace Plane Program, the NAS program, started. And that's where I got introduced to the University of Queensland, Dr. Ray Stalker, who was kind of the pioneer over in Australia in hypersonics. So they did a lot of good work. They got a lot of good facilities. And, of course, they have a huge open area to do flight testing, because that's essentially what you need with the hypersonic testing, at least the processes that they use, because you're going so fast, you cover a lot of ground in a very short amount of time.
So I assume, because you want and need real hard flight data, your R&D costs for hypersonics must be through the roof.
Exactly. That's the whole problem. And I think, there was a big push to develop some low-cost flight testing or at least there was a want there to develop some low-cost flight testing. But it was hard for the communities to get off the traditional way of flight testing, which was always expensive. It basically, you know, in order to get up to those high speeds, it requires a lot of energy. And, you know, the typical way to do it is to use solid rocket boosters like, you know, the Terrier the Air Force
Ryan.
and Australia are using now. It's very expensive, whether they're flying out of Australia or the
Norway.
Pacific Missile Range. It's very expensive the way that they're doing it. So we took a different tact at it, where everyone was looking at, you know, the cost of flight testing being too high and saying that scramjet technology was too difficult. We said, well, the problem is in scramjet technology because you have so few people that are actually, you know, knee-deep into the flight testing itself. The problem is flight testing. You've got to get the cost down. You have to be able to do more of it. And kind of proof in the pudding is if you take the more recent HiFly program that was done by DARPA and the Office of Naval Research, they were flight testing a what's called a dual mode ramjet scramjet configuration that has a lot of history down at John Hopkins, and they conducted three flight tests, and all three flight tests I'm not going to call them failures, but they didn't test the ramjet or scramjet flow path. They had other issues with subcomponents that essentially deep six the flight test. And the first one was a software issue. The second one was a fuel delivery issue. And the third one was a battery issue. I mean, with the third one, the thing just dropped dead right off the plane that was carrying it. So, and it's not to say that, you know, that there was anything wrong with the people technically setting up the program and everything. It's just these things happen. And you have to develop the either the reliability in the system, which means, you know, flight testing this same system multiple times to get some kind of history, or it's scaling back and saying, hey, how do we develop this lower cost, get the time to first flight down to, you know, a couple of months instead of 4 or 5 years? That's really the thing that's expensive. So they have to look at it different, and that's what we did at Vault and in Vault Enterprises. Yeah, that's where we're pushing, is we really came down and said, hey, let's look at doing this low cost. So that's where we are, you know, that's where our big focus was.
Okay, I've got a listener question for you, and I've got my own question. So my listener question is George in Albuquerque. And he says, this is probably foolish given the introduction you have just given us to what you're doing as well as hypersonics in general, but can we even consider a human-controlled or human-passengered hypersonic, or is that years or decades away?
Well, I would not put a human in there unless they had some real interest in not being around very long.
Well, you get one of the Mars people, they might go to hypersonic instead. You never know.
I mean, this is the fastest race car you'll ever be on, I guess, you know. With all the electronics, with the advances in electronics and the capability that's out there in unmanned systems now, there's just there's no reason to put a human in it, not to mention you would have to add in all of that extra subsystems and components in order to get that person in that aircraft and hopefully stay alive. So I would do it an unmanned system just like we're doing, and really it's got a shorter term to market doing that, because, you know, if you're sending up nanosatellites, for instance, you know, you can get there much quicker if you're not going to be putting a person in it. So,
but
besides, it would be too.
I was going to say, we talk about, and I'm guilty of this, that all these people will call the show and they'll say, we need suborbital for point-to-point transportation. And the people that are true engineers who have educated me over the years tell me that point-to-point suborbital is pretty complicated and BS, and you're going to be making two-thirds of an orbit anyway, and you've got reentry problems and da-da-da-da-da. But if you had hypersonic transportation in the exo-atmosphere, you wouldn't have launch penalties and you wouldn't have a lot of other things. So ultimately, if you want really, really fast transportation, hypersonic seems a possibility, and that would be with humans. So are we talking decades away from anything like that?
I would say we are, for do anything with humans. You know, if you're talking endo-atmospheric, exo-atmospheric, you know, maybe not, but I think you got to really look at, you know, the return on the investment there, too, because if you're going to put someone, you know, out into space, you know, maybe not go up to orbital speed, you're still talking about a fairly fast speed, so the rockets to do that are going to be fairly sizable, so... You know, it's going to be quite expensive. Anytime you have to launch a rocket, it's going to be expensive just because of, you know, what it is. I mean, and you know, essentially the rocket's carrying its own fuel and oxidizer, and the oxidizer is anywhere from, you know, 2 to 8 times the weight of the fuel. So, you know, the majority of all the launch vehicles are oxidizer because they're all, you know, rocket-based. The air-breathing benefit really comes in not having to carry all that oxidizer. But you have to use it, you know, the right way. If you look at the National Aerospace Plane Program, you know, and theoretically they wanted to have that a single stage to orbit, where you would run an air breathing, essentially a jet engine, all the way to orbital velocity. Theoretically you probably could. Would it actually get there? Maybe not, but you know, if you got to do a small kick at the end with a rocket motor, you know, you're making progress. But the problem that really comes up in those systems with NASA, essentially, which was a manned system, but they were trying to essentially replace the rockets that go up to space now. The problem was is that those large vehicles were going to carry the equivalent payload of the rockets that they were going to, you know, compete against or replace. And so they had to take a much lower flight angle to orbit where a rocket could go essentially straight up. The NASP would be, you know, going out 1,000 miles in order to go up 15. So you're spending a lot more operation time, which means that even though you're not carrying the oxidizer, you're carrying a lot more fuel. And then being inside the atmosphere with the heating, you've got the thermal management issues, and those are some of the same issues that they're, you know, that they have with the long range weapon systems. It comes down to thermal management. But that was one of the real killers in NASA. And so it's you know, it's a difficult scenario to kind of figure out and how to do the point to point person, but I think, you know, taking the small steps initially, like we're doing the small steps with Vault, that's what you, I think that's a better way to go and then work up to a manned system.
So right now, as I understand it, and we've kind of been all over the board, so I want to clear this up, Vault's goal is to make low-cost flight testing for hypersonics a reality. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the goal that we initially started out with, and we kind of ramped that up once we saw the need in the nanosatellite community. So we said, well, geez, can we use a high-speed air breather to put these small payloads into orbit? And so the answer to us was basically yes. As long as the payload weight is small, we can take a trajectory more like a rocket, essentially go straight up, and then make that time, you know, very short. So we're basically taking out the thermal management issues while we're using the air breather, but it's a combination rocket and air breather. So it's like a first step towards the orbital placement of a satellite. So that's where we started off with the low-cost hypersonic flight testing, and we're kind of doing both of those now, and the nanosatellite one, just because of the market that's out there, and what Vault would do as a benefit in terms of shrinking that launch vehicle down, I think is very marketable.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of speeds do you get in your flight testing?
Well, in the flight testing right now, we have a first stage rocket booster, and then we went through the second stage, which is the air breather. It's a combination of ramjet and scramjet. The ramjet would be the lower end, where we're starting that up around in between Mach 1.5 and Mach 2, and then switching over to scramjet, which is a supersonic combustion ramjet, which we don't slow the flow down inside the engine below subsonic, so that we keep the temperatures down, and then we can run at a much much higher speeds. What we've accomplished so far in our first steps, our first milestones, is the development of the booster, the development of the process of the launch system, and we do all this vertical. Development of the process, we've developed the booster, flight tested that. We did the separation of the two stages, as well as the shroud deployment of the inlet on the ramjet. And then we had kind of a Kickstarter, I'll just call it a ducted rocket kind of configuration, where we got 4 G's of acceleration going straight up. So we are only, we didn't put any liquid fuel, we didn't have any liquid fuel in that one, but where we got 4 G's acceleration. But essentially what we're doing now is stepping on the gas and going faster and faster.
So I'm getting a lot of questions, and I think they're kind of overlapping, but I'm not 100% sure, because this is sort of a new field for me, so I'm not playing the great pretender here on hypersonics.
No problem. We'll work through it.
I'm learning along with a lot of the listeners. So I've got a question which I think overlaps some of the others, but I'm going to read you Sean from Colorado's question, and then we'll see if it's overlapping with some of the others. Can your guest talk about flight testing that has already been accomplished at Vault? How many flights have you done, and how many does he feel are necessary to create the reliable system, and what is the cost goal per launch?
Yep. This is for the orbital system. We do have a plan, a 3-year plan for that. We've already done 22 flight tests, and like I said, it was, you know, it's really a stepped, very agile, iterative process that we go through, so that we don't get bit by the small sub component issues that the high fly program and those have when you start putting a lot more money and expense into the system. But we've done 22 flight tests. We hammered out a lot of the electronics, the data taken, telemetry, onboard data acquisition, fuel system, a number of the different components, to get this thing to where we're ready to, inject the fuel and step on the gas. From where we're at right now, we anticipate 3 years. We have about 38 flight tests that we'll be doing before, 38 that includes 6 that will be orbital. Orbital demonstration. And so after those 38, I'd say that we'll have a pretty reliable system, and also the manufacturing processes down to where we can be a lot more efficient in giving the nanosatellite customers some reliability and consistency in the flight's orbit. So that's where we're at now.
I was going to ask you how many years till you've accomplished that number of flight tests and developed the system.
3 years.
Three years. Okay.
Yep. That's the track we're on. Three years.
I have a question from Sally, who's in Seattle, and she says, "I'm new to the game. What is the difference between a scramjet and a ramjet?"
It's a good question, Sally. The ramjet is essentially, it's a supersonic engine that runs in supersonic flight conditions, but as the flow comes into the engine, it's basically slowed down so that you get a pressure rise inside the engine and inside the combustor. So it slows down below the speed of sound relative to the engine. So looking, you know, at the engine, relative to the engine, the flow will be subsonic, and then when it goes back out the nozzles, typically goes back supersonic. It depends, but it could be subsonic as well. In a scramjet, which is a supersonic combustion ramjet, the flow does not go down below the speed of sound. It stays supersonic, and the reason being is the temperature at the higher Mach numbers, as you slow it down, the static temperature will go up so that, you know, injecting fuel might not do anything. It might just degrade the fuel at the higher flight speed. So in order to get the heat release out of the fuel, out of the chemical energy in the fuel and get the work in terms of thrust, you got to let the speed of the flow running through the engine stay supersonic. So that's essentially the difference. So then you have a wider range and speed.
So the scramjet is where you ultimately want to be in your development program. Would that be fair?
That's correct. Scramjet is definitely, because the ramjet's only going to get you to a certain Mach number. And if you're going to orbital velocity, you're talking about 17,500 miles an hour. It's about Mach 24-ish. 24 times the speed of sound. So if you're only getting up to Mach 5, Mach 6 with a ramjet, a scramjet can take you, to a lot higher speed. Theoretically, it's always been touted that it could get to Mach 24, Mach 25, but realistically, we're still waiting for that Mach 24 or 25. NASA did demonstrate a scramjet at Mach 10 back in 2004 with the HyperX program, the X-43. They had some really good results with the flight tests that they did under that program. It's just that they were so expensive. But anyways, that's the difference. We hope to get up to Mach 12 plus. If we get to Mach 12, we'll have a really good, size on what our vehicle is going to be. But if we get to 15, 16, it'll make it even better, that much better for us in making a lighter third stage rocket.
How does this work? Do you charge the taxpayers or the government per flight test, or is it a bulk kind of arrangement? And then I'm assuming that you are probably overloaded with lessons learned both from your own experience and other hypersonic research. Is that true? And can you actually apply all of the lessons learned, or is it overwhelming, or how can you deal with it in order to use it for the benefit of Vault?
Yeah, no, there's actually a very rich history out there in ramjet and actually scramjet technology. And actually, when we started flying these things in this country, probably going back to the mid-1940s with the Bumblebee program at a John Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, where they were starting to fly, they flew the Cobra, which was a 6-inch diameter, basically a combustor. But they got some good speeds. They demonstrated that Mach 2, 6.4-ish, somewhere around there, and then they continued on with their ramjet flight testing there. And in the late 1950s, they actually fielded the first ramjet surface-to-air missile, which was the Talos for the Navy. It was a big behemoth, but it was a, you know, we fielded them back then. We were doing quite a bit of flight testing. And then the Air Force, you had the Bomark, which was fielded in the late 1950s as well. And that was basically a surface-to-air missile to knock out or to intercept planes at a long range, or should say bombers. You know, it was one of the focus areas until the ICBM came into play with carrying nuclear weapons. So there's a really healthy program, flight test program in ramjets, and they're very mature. Scramjet was kind of a different sort. The X-15 program from back in the 50s, and believe it or not, we have history of the X-15 here in Maine. One of the lead pilots, actually the pilot that had the most flights in the X-15 was from Maine. But anyways, the X-15 was set to test a scramjet attached to the bottom of it back in the 60s until the program was grounded in the late 60s. And this was a NASA program called the Hypersonic Research Engine Program. And they did put a dummy scramjet at the bottom of it. And they realized that they couldn't hang a scramjet from a pylon like they do with subsonic aircraft, because the shockwave coming off the nose of that actually ripped into the skin of the X-15, and luckily enough, they landed the airplane before they destroyed it completely. But yeah, there's a lot of history, and it is unfortunate that the NASA program, with as much money that was put into it, and the different agencies that were in there, they never got a flight test off. And that was really, kind of concerning. And it's there's always too much planning and too much wants and needs that they want to throw onto these launch vehicles. And they got to keep back everyone and say, let's get a vehicle that's low cost. We can do many flight tests, and we'll get people on these flight tests and test the systems and test this and that. Instead of doing it all at once, we'll do it on multiple flight tests, and they'll get a lot more reliability out of the system, the flight test platform that they're developing, and it'll result in a lot more data for them. But it just never came off like that. But there is a lot of history out there, and it's done us very well to go back and look at that history, and we got some very good ideas on how to design different pieces, parts, and components involved. But we also have some of our internal in-house techniques and design tools that we use to move that vehicle forward. But Vault is a different. When we're talking about this, most of it going vertical, and I will say that the NACA testing back in the 50s was excellent, which was done at Wallop. And if you type in, and the listeners can do this, if they type in NACA ramjet flight test, they should see a YouTube video of a 1955 ramjet flight test, a 6-inch diameter ramjet. And that program was called the F-29 program. And they made so much progress in that. Granted, NACA was doing all of this for longer range weapon development, not anything for space. But they did some really good work. They learned a lot, and we started doing Vault kind of a similar way, and it just turned out that once we found that, it was kind of comforting to know that someone back in the people in the 50s were doing this, and it actually worked like we thought it was going to work.
Carl, the video says confidential on it, and it's on YouTube. Do we need a Senate hearing on this or something?
I
just don't know here. Did YouTube violate something? It has confidential in big black and white letters on it. I'm watching the video right now.
Yeah, I guess think have left that on there, but it's out there. The information is out there. It's a matter of finding, the information. But it was a really good round of testing that they did. Different types of fuels, and they learned a lot. And it was unfortunate that. Interagency problems back then actually squashed the program.
Let me change your pace a little bit and read you the email from the listener that I sent you before the show started, but the listeners don't know this. So this is from Jody, and she's a space enthusiast from Silicon Valley, and she has four quick questions for you. I've gotten conflicting advice on the value of pricing models that companies use for weight to dollar. Can you comment on whether or not this is even a relevant metric for you and the industry? Number two, what is unique about your company, Vault? Number three, what motivates you? What do you find is your biggest challenge? And number four, I've read Vault was recently recognized at Mass Innovation Night. Can you share something about Mass Innovation Night?
Yeah, yeah, that was good. I'll start with the last one there. Yeah, we attended Mass Innovation Night, which is really for startups to kind of ramp up the PR in startups. And this was their 100th event. They have them, I guess, every night, and it was focuses on space technology, and it was located at the Boston Museum of Science, and Draper in Cambridge was the sponsor for it. So, we went there and we pitched like the other small businesses there, and we were voted the favorite. So we came away with that with a very nice feeling. So, anyways, I thought I'd start with that one.
Okay.
Question number one about the metric cost per unit weight. That's a metric that's been used out there in the launch industry for a number of years, and I think for the big launch vehicles, it probably makes sense, especially when you have a bunch of competitors that are dealing with the same customers, and they were all kind of designed for a heavy payload. But basically where that number comes from is basically the cost, the launch cost of that system divided by the payload capability, not actually what they put up there, but what's the capability of the vehicle. And so they come up with this number that might be, $10,000 per pound, $15,000, $20,000. That is a metric that everyone is using in the launch industry. And this is where it gets kind of interesting when nanosatellites come on board, because the nanosatellite crew, if they're using that same metric, they don't have a vehicle that really fits the bill for them, because all of the launch vehicles out there, I mean, if you take the Falcon 9, for instance, which is, I think, far being the most common launch vehicle, at least in the U.S., for putting payloads into orbit. At least the one generating the most interest and the most excitement in the launch industry. They can carry about 50,000 pounds of payload into low Earth orbit. And when you're talking about a nanosatellite, that might be being 1 kilogram or thereabouts, 2 to 3 pounds of weight, it really doesn't match up. So basically what you're talking about is can I get that cost per pound for a nanosatellite going up? And so that cost per pound that they have out there in the launch industry to me, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, especially when you're coming to the NATO satellites, because their real need, a lot of them need, is to get to a certain orbit at a certain time. And what the only option that they have right now is a rideshare, because they are so small compared to the payload capacity of the launch vehicle. And the only way to get around that is to bring the payload capacity down to the size of the satellites that you want to put up, or, you know, somewhere close to it. And you just can't do that with the launch systems that are out there currently, especially Falcon 9. So you go on as rideshare. SpaceX will typically work with a broker like Space Flight Services, and they'll be the ones that manifest the space available onto a Falcon 9. And so I don't believe that you're going to get SpaceX dealing directly with the NATO satellite customers. So you basically go to a broker, and that broker's going to have a price tag to it. On how much per 1U or 3U. And I think Space Flight Services posts their prices on the web. And I think a 3U is somewhere around $295,000 per 3U, which is, I guess, up to about 5 kilograms. So, and that ends up being around $50,000, $59,000 per kilogram. So, you know, if you're trying to meet that, you're still going to be forced into a rideshare situation. And what we're trying to do at Vault is we looked at the problem and said, okay, well, how can we shrink the size of this launch vehicle way down so we can give them a dedicated ride, give them exactly where they want to go in orbit and when they want to go. And we see that as being critical to a lot of groups, Spire, Planet. We see that's been something that's been holding them up from getting the revenue. And I think that the industry is really going to come into its own once that capability is there. And so with Vault, when we looked at how do we shrink that vehicle down, that's where the only answer to us was to use a combination of rocket and high-speed air breather, because launch vehicles, as they are with all rocket propulsion, they're about 90% propellant by weight, and again, that oxidizer is 2 to 8 times the weight of the fuel, depending on the fuel that you're using. So it's a huge portion of that vehicle, and if we can use the oxygen in the atmosphere to get to space, and we can shrink it down. And essentially, if you look at the, hopefully I'm not going on here too long, but if you look at the smallest launch vehicle that ever put an orbiting satellite, up into orbit, it was the Lambda 4S by Japan, an all solid, 3 to 4 stages. It was, over 20,000 pounds. Total gross liftoff weight for a 25-kilogram payload, about 55 pounds. So it's a huge system. And Vault, what we're looking at is the same payload capability, but 1,500 pounds. That's how much we've been able to shrink it.
Okay, Jody has two more quick questions for you, and let's see, I have dinner at 4 hours from now, so let's see how we can handle this. What is unique about Vault, and what motivates you? Since Elise is back there laughing, maybe you should take a rest and she should answer that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she can. It's easy enough on the unique about Vault.
Let her take a pass at it. So what's unique about Vault and what motivates you guys?
Okay, so I would suggest that Vault is very unique as compared to many of the other Vaults right now. Vault is certainly going to be the smallest launch vehicle available on the market. It also will be able to launch from multiple platforms, from air, land, and sea. And when we say air, there was a recent study that we conducted with the Navy conducted and analyzed Vault for launch off the bottom of an F-18. And we could also launch Vault from Aegis, from the vertical launch systems that on the destroyers.
Okay.
That's correct. So it's perfectly sized at full scale. It'll be about 20 feet tall. And is it 2 feet in diameter, Carl?
Yes.
And yes. So we'll be able to provide Navy access to space, which I think would be incredible to have as a capability in theater. So to add
something,
Vault is also going to be able to be launched from the greatest number of spaceports due to its safety features. Vault does not carry the oxidizer on board, which is also what allows us to shrink the vehicle down to such a small size. But it also makes for a much safer system, which will enable us to provide economic development opportunities to numerous states across the nation and even internationally that are motivated to capture a bit of the emerging nanosatellite market.
So what motivates you guys?
Well, that's a loaded question right there.
Well, it's Jody's question, not mine.
Yeah, I know, and I don't know what I have to say to Jody about that one right now.
I have to have a little talk with her about
this. There are lots of things that motivate me personally, but I think that probably from a technical standpoint, Carl could answer what motivates him in terms of hypersonics, and then I can tell you that as a business, we jointly care very deeply. Our company cares about STEM very a great deal, cares about job creation, cares about advancing the curriculum for the schools of mechanical engineering across the country. You know, we certainly care about addressing some of the fundamental issues that a lot of small businesses face as trying to work with the defense industry.
It sounds like you want to make America great again, right?
We kind of do want to make America great again, as a matter of fact.
God help me for that one.
I think she hit most of the major points. For me personally, you know, I've been in the hypersonics world for so long, my whole career. I really want to make something useful. And I just, you know, I think that this application for nanosatellites, I mean, there's definitely a need out there. It's not like it's not like the weapon systems out there. It's actually going towards, benefit growing, expanding the new space economy. That all, you know, rings with me and, you know, after looking at hypersonics and doing this stuff for so long and having, friends that have gone through their whole careers in hypersonics and never been part of a flight test, I just cringe at that happening to me. So I really have an interest in making this usable, making it work, especially for nanosatellites, because that's like front and center in new space industry. And I think that we have a real opportunity to shine here. And it's a total different animal than what they're doing on the weapons side, though, where they're looking at mostly long-range cruisers. We're looking at accelerators in a very short amount of time. So we're looking at a totally different animal, and the way our approach to this is also going to be much quicker in development time. I just see that happening. So, but the challenge is, you know, being stuck in the perception the history of what a lot of folks think, you know, that scramjets, there isn't a system that's out there yet. So, but to me, it's just that there's more flight that's needed. There's a different approach that's needed, and that's what Vault's doing. So,
okay.
One more comment, if I might.
Yeah, go ahead,
sure.
Elise.
I think another thing that I would like to mention that I didn't say when you asked me initially is, you know, national security is a major concern. Our soaring debt, and how do we create the means by which to decrease the cost of flight testing in order to advance these capabilities within a reasonable time frame as well. You know, so time and money are big factors in everything that we make decisions about with regards to Vault. You know, how can we save money? How can we save time? And how can we do it quickly? You know? So,
okay. A couple of things. I'm going to skip the break because I'm inundated with questions by email.
Sure.
Unfortunately, you guys aren't calling. So the phone number, if you would actually like to call us, because that is the preferable way to communicate with the Space Show, is 1-866-687-7223. So I'm going to go through these email questions. We're not going to take a break. So Ted is in San Diego, and Ted says there are many, at least rhetoric-wise and with a few tests behind them, small dedicated launchers emerging into the marketplace out of New Zealand, Vector, and a couple of others. Are you going to be going head-to-head in competition with these, and how can you compete with them?
Okay.
Carl,
that's a very good question.
Yes, we are, but I'll let Carl answer that question.
Yeah, you know, from a, I don't know, just looking at the animals, the other vehicles, Rocket Labs out of New Zealand, actually it's U.S.-based.
You're right.
They're all rocket propulsion. I think that their payload that they're looking at is somewhere around 150 kilograms to low Earth orbit. And I think that their price is right around $5 million per launch is what they're looking at. Vector Space, I believe, is a payload starts at about 30 kilograms and I think goes up to about 100 kilograms, or maybe it might be a little bit larger than that, the Vector H. There's a Vector R and a Vector H that they're working on. The 30-kilogram payload vehicle for Vector, we would be kind of a direct competitor with because of the payload size. So I can see, actually all of them, I can see we'd be direct competitors with, but it's really going to come down to a, you know, does the customer need to control the time and place that they go into orbit? And if you've got like a couple six U's that are going up, you're going to want to put them on a vehicle that is, you know, that's going to essentially come up somewhere close to the payload capacity, so that you save some dollars. So if you look at, I'm not sure what Vector's price range, I believe, is in the $1.5 million to about $3 million, but I'm not quite sure on the specifics there. Vault is going to be at $1.75 million to start at 25 kilogram payload. However, as Elise pointed out, we're not going to have the same launch limitations in terms of, you know, having to go to a traditional launch site in order to launch this, because we're so small and so light. So we have a lot more flexibility. On the Rocket Lab side, they're going to be more costly in the launch system itself. So I know I had just read, and I think it was the hosted payload conference that was down at APL last month. I had just read that Spire was still looking at the new nano satellite launchers, that they would still be essentially rideshare on those because the payload capacity was higher than what they were, traditionally what they're looking at. I mean, they're putting up three U's, Planet's putting up three U's. So if you want to really put these things pinpoint where they're going, you need a dedicated system that's going to have a payload capacity that's fairly low. And we're going to be a lot smaller than Vector's just because of the air breathing components of the launch vehicle.
Well, are you going to, will you be entering the market fast enough and on a time basis to be competitive with these guys? Because Rocket Labs is already flight testing, and Vector's gotten a big kick in the butt of $25 million or something like that, and is, you know, going full bore. And there are probably some, I don't know what Virgin is doing with their one that they've got. But so can you enter on a timely basis to be competitive?
I think so, because I think one of the things, and Elise can chime in here too, thinking about the market, I think there's going to be more opportunities that actually come out of the woodwork once these small launchers get into place. Because, I mean, if you look at the estimates now or the projections on future launches for nano satellites, they don't have the capability right now to go where and when. They don't have that reliable and consistent launch. So they're pushing out revenue on these small companies quite a ways. So if we can get a few of these small launchers in the queue to start putting these things up, I think what you're going to find is there's going to be a lot more interest in, maybe it's not in the commercial side, maybe there's some of it in the government military side, but they say, hey, we want to get up there really quick. We want to get up there, you know, next week. Can you do it, kind of thing? And that's where Vault's really going to shine. I don't know what the other guys have plans in terms of. I mean, you know, are they dictating the times and when they're going to launch, or are they letting the customer, basically say, well, we're going to launch, you know, this time in this place, and that's where the flexibility comes in for us. That's what we want to give them.
Okay. I got a caller for you. You ready?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Yeah, hi. This is Rick in Silicon Valley trying to preempt things because I actually, wow, I'm getting feedback on that.
Your phone sucks, so let's see if you can make it work.
Let's see how far.
Because you're cutting out all over the place, so let's try it. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay. So first of all, I put this discuss, but I'm going to go ahead and ask this anyway. So first of all, I'm one of the people that got in some interesting CubeSat or whatever discussion on LinkedIn with Carl, and that was a whole lot of fun. And I showed up later at DIUX. I don't know if you remember that meeting.
Yes.
We do.
I do. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. Yeah, that was very interesting. So I've been very interested in seeing what's been going on so far. So let me see. So get to my question. So I'm not actually a propulsion user, and I wonder if my assumptions are wrong and stuff. So I understand that scramjets are less efficient than ramjets. This is sort of like Pacific Impulse, but I somehow think Pacific Impulse doesn't really apply to air breathing engines. And then ramjets are supposed to be less efficient than turbojets, right? So that was kind of the first part I wanted to clear up.
Yes. Efficient in the way of basically,
well, I was thinking amount of thrust for the
specific
way
impulse.
Of engine.
Because specific impulse is, it's a measure for air breathers, it's a measure for rockets. Because it's the thrust divided by the mass flow, essentially in propellant that you're throwing into the system. So, the air breathers will have a much higher specific impulse, and the higher speed you go. Actually, the turbojets are going to be higher, piston engines will be up above them, but the turbojets will be high, very high, and then as you go up in speed, the turbojet's going to fall off, and then ramjets is going to come into play. And then the ramjets are going to go from about Mach 2-ish up to 5 or 6, where it's going to cross over with the scramjet because of the limitations, in running ramjet mode. So you're going to see these crossovers. It's not that they can't go into each other's territory, so to speak, but you'll basically going to be favoring one system over the other. They're all working on the same Brayton cycle, thermodynamic cycle. But what you'll see at the higher end in scramjets, because it's going to be basically a higher specific impulse, and that's really the key with the rocket technology in order to get the orbital velocity that you need. what you're going to see is that there's this natural transition over to a rocket. Because you get going higher and higher with scramjet, you're going to see the performance drop off. And, of course, some of the vehicle's drag and weight is going to come into play in that area as well. But yeah, that's pretty much the normal cycle is you're going to see at those speed, you know, depending on what speed range you're at, you're going to want to set with one engine system over another. But so, definitely in the, as you're getting over Mach 2, you're going to want to go into ramjet rather than a turbine and then over to a scramjet after about Mach 6 or so.
So the other thing that I've kind of heard from people is that, the impression I've gotten is that scramjets cannot accelerate very fast. Maybe you can comment on that. Leave it at that.
That's an excellent question, too, because that is the perception out there that the thrust-to-weight ratio of scramjet systems is very low. One of the key factors in that is the weight, the weight of the system. So if you build a boat, you know, with everything but the kitchen sink or everything and the kitchen sink on there, it's going to be a slow goer. This is why the big systems, the big launch or the big scramjet-powered systems like NAS, which ended up being huge. It started out at 50,000 pounds, but then went up to 500,000 pounds. But that's why they have to take such a, you know, a low flight angle to orbit is because they're, you know, the way that they're designed, the thrust to weight ratio is very low. So your acceleration rate's going to be lower. It'll work in some systems. But if you want to go to orbit, you want to get there quickly, lighten the thing up. That's what we're doing with Vault. That's the key because when you lighten those up, you can take these things straight up again. And I think that if you're looking at that NACA video, it's going to tell a story right there. Yeah.
Okay, I guess that's it for me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rick.
Listeners, that line is available if anybody wants to use it, hopefully with a better phone line than Rick had. But we're glad to hear him. 1-866-687-7223. I've got more emails for you, so let me go through a couple of these, okay? So this is the one I told you about before the show started, but that I didn't tell you what the question was. So here it is. There has been an extended discussion on the Space Show blog, and by the way, this is the largest Space Show blog discussion I think I've had ever, with well over 200 plus emails going back and forth, and
wow,
if you really read them all, you may need to be in the funny farm. Okay, there has been extended discussion on the Space Show blog about using, so this is a question about hypersonic technology in general, about using large airships to gain cheap access to LEO. They would start from a station of approximately 140,000 feet and gradually accelerate and climb to orbital altitude and velocity. One individual and prolific blog poster, Robert the Inventor, has been a forceful proponent of using the WaveWriter concept on a very thin-skinned airship using beams rigidized by internal gas pressure to go through the hypersonic regime at high altitude using solar cells and some form of electric propulsion. He also appears to think that the LD ratios of several hundred to one are possible in this altitude and speed regime. My recollection is that the best sailplanes have LD ratios of about 60, and the old XB-70 had an LD ratio of about 5 or 6 when surfing on its own shockwave. What are your thoughts? Also, if the vehicle is non-rigid, like an airship, how likely is it that the vehicle could sustain its shape and sustain the lift riding on its own shockwave?
Silence. Well, that's a good question. With the hypersonics, if you're just thinking, and if I'm grasping his question correctly, he's talking about going up in an airship to a high altitude, basically a balloon.
Right.
To a high altitude and then starting this thing up. And that's just not, well, I shouldn't say it's not possible. You're going to have to use some kind of propulsion to get it up to speed.
Well, he's using solar electric power.
Yeah,
and it's not rigid. Keep in mind that the frame of this is not rigid.
Yeah. Well, the scramjet flow path basically works. As a plane is flying through the air, the scramjet flow path is working the air that it hit. I mean, if you look at this thing kind of like a snowplow, and I say that because I'm from Maine, but it's plowing into the air molecules to do that. So it's scooping the air molecules up, and it's contracting essentially the area in order to boost the pressure. You need the pressure from a thermodynamic standpoint. You need to boost the pressure in order to get work out of the system. In the normal cycle, you're going to boost the pressure. You're going to throw fuel in. You're going to ignite the fuel so that it releases the energy and expands that energy back down to an ambient pressure. If you have a non-rigid structure, you're just going to, I don't see how the structure survives. If you're up there high enough, you have to push it faster in order to get enough air into the system, in order to have, combustion and some kind of thrust. So, I don't see how it's possible with a non-rigid. Now it can be morphing. But it's got to be rigid at a point to where you can work, throw energy into the air in order to compress it, and then mix it with your fuel and burn it and get some, a greater work output so that it actually pushes you forward. But other than that, I don't see how an airship, and this is the thing about air breathers too. Different than how you'd think about rockets, because rockets, if they could launch at a high altitude and it was easy enough for them, it would be better because it reduces the drag on the vehicle. But with an air breather, you need that air. So having that air available in the lower atmosphere actually helps you get up to speed, so to speak, or else you got to push it faster the higher you go before you start up the engine.
So
that makes sense.
I take it that Robert, the inventor, should probably not spend much time on inventing this one, right?
I wouldn't go in that direction, no.
Okay, you have a caller, and I still have more emails to read. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hey, Dr. Livingston. Thank you so much for taking my call. My name is Jose. I'm on travel in New York City. I'm a big fan of Walt and Carl and Elise, and know them pretty well.
Awesome.
But I would like to ask one question to the team, and it is, can you explain the value proposition, Carl and then Elise, once you've accomplished all the goals you've set once, and then share with all the listeners the impact that you're looking to do globally, not just with government, but also with education and schools and so forth?
Sure. That's an excellent question. Elise, do you want me to start this one? And you can kind of chime in. I'm sure you can chime in on some of the marketing. But for Vault, anyways, the value proposition that we have to the customers that are out there is we're going to be able to give them the where and when to orbit that they want, especially if we're looking at some of the nanosatellite customers out there that have been waiting years or have or will be waiting years in order to establish their constellations, where revenue is really dependent on the constellations being up 100% and running, it's going to make a big impact on that. So we want to be able to put these guys up or establish their constellation in 2 months compared to 2 years or so that it's taking them now. And we hope that it's going to bring more customers into the marketplace at that point, so that we can really establish a kind of a new space architecture for nanosatellites and hopefully in even a lower Earth orbit and get back to the, replace them once every year or 2 years instead of, I think they're going up to 5 years now with replacement because it's so difficult to get up there. So that's really a value proposition that we have for Vault. That's going to be, I think it's going to be a bit different than other competitors out there, certainly than what the traditional launch folks are doing now with the rideshare. But in the bigger picture, which is very good question, is we've got a lot of other things planned with the educational side, the aerospace education, STEM. We've already had a number of students run through our summer programs here to give them flight test experience, which is something that we're losing grasp of in this country. And the hands-on portion of it also gives them a really good feedback from the regular classwork that a lot of these folks will get into. So we do, and especially in the state of Maine, excuse me, where we really want to help build the aerospace industry. So we're looking to really ramp that up quite a bit. And Elise, did you want to chime in here?
I would love to chime in. I was just having a little bit of wind in my own headphones, so I was trying to find a quieter place. But thank you so much for calling, Jose. I appreciate it.
Hello.
And I apologize.
We're losing you. Elise, we're losing
All right.
you.
Good Lord. Oh. I'm sorry about that. The dog just started barking, and I apologize.
We allow dogs to bark on the space show, so that
you do. Oh,
yes,
thank you.
What kind of dog is it?
That's wonderful.
What kind?
It's a Labradoodle.
Okay.
And it's loud. It has a deep voice, and it yells and screams at everything that walks by. And I just need to call it in. And this is absolutely embarrassing, but I apologize.
I let my husky sing on the show, so your Labradoodle can do whatever.
Jose, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate your question and you taking the time to call in. Carl started to mention how we were going to be working with universities and what our intentions are there. And I see that there is a great potential for far more participation in the suborbital regime and for providing flight test opportunities to advance the TRL levels, technology readiness levels, of the various systems and subsystem components that nanosatellite developers across the world are working on right now. And there's also a method for coordinating them more closely and providing them with an opportunity to engage in open collaboration and we would like to support the growth of the future nanosatellite industry by working with the academic community very closely. Utilizing our platform ultimately so that we can help to enhance educational opportunities within classroom settings. So our platform has proven very beneficial to us, and as a teaching tool, it would be very beneficial to incorporate it into some of the curriculums in the schools of mechanical engineering across the country. The methodologies we employ, we believe would be highly beneficial to us accessing intellectual capital within each of the universities that are working across the country on the hypersonic side and helping that to grow, as well as working with the nanosatellite developers at the undergrad and graduate level to help groom them essentially into entrepreneurship. So we just see, I've been analyzing the industry for since I think it began around 2012 and mapping it out very closely and examining the competition and the shortcomings with regard to what's missing, so to speak. And if we work more closely together, we believe that we can help to close the gap in terms of the missions that would would provide an opportunity for those developers then to transfer into entrepreneurs that we can then launch, right? So that's part of our goal, is to really tightly coordinate the industry.
I'll throw in another thing here, too, is, you know, Vault has a lot of application in the suborbital world, and some of it, you know, of course, is government, but there's a lot of different applications that folks are looking for high-speed air breathers. And so, you know, the access to space is one part of Vault. It's actually, it's the most exciting part because of the need that's out there in the commercial sector and the interest that folks have. But there is a huge suborbital sector, and these are for products, not just for doing, you know, as a flight test platform, but also for products.
That's right.
So Vault's got a really good line, I think, to a lot of different applications that really is good for, you know, return on investment in a number of different areas, different applications. So that's an excellent question, though, Jose.
Jose, anything else, or are you...
The only comment is, Dr. Livingston, class act, thank you for all you do for the space industry.
Thank you.
We're quiet and behind the scenes watching you. Great job, and thanks for highlighting somebody like Vault, led by Elise and Carl. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Jose.
So, listeners, for transparency's sake, boy, how often do we hear that word these days, right?
Right.
And how often does anyone saying it mean it? But I do mean it. So I want to give a shout out to Michael Listener, who all of you know through our Space Law shows with Michael, because Michael first put me in contact with Elise. It was his recommendation. And then I began following up with Elise, and we worked out a meeting at the Space Foundation. So I do appreciate Michael for introducing me to Vault and to Carl and to Elise. And
As do we.
I was just going to say. Thank you very much, Michael.
Listeners, I appreciate your referrals and references to people that should be on the Space Show, and Michael is a good example of that. And so I just want to thank him for making all of this possible. Also, since we're not taking a break today, I do want to thank AIAA as a sponsor, as well as Orbital ATK. We appreciate their sponsorship very much for the program. Dan sent in an email, which I believe you've already answered, but I will ask it, and you can probably retire it really quickly because I think we have covered it. He says, does Carl think Vault could be employed in a mobile setting? For instance, a dedicated space lift squadron, which could launch from remote parts of the world or perhaps from a Navy ship. What is a space lift squadron, Carl?
I think the caller is using it in a certain sense. You know, I know who asked the question, so I know that. I know where it's coming from.
Yeah, I do too, and he's going to be on the show in the near future. But I've not heard the term space lift squadron before.
I actually hadn't either, but it's a good
descriptor. Yeah, I would say you know, this is another thing that kind of differentiates us from the other orbital class launch systems is Vault is going to be small enough. As Elise had mentioned, too, to fit in some of the vertical launch systems that are in the Aegis Destroyer. We could also set them up in tubes like you would see some weapon systems, you know, launch tubes. And, you know, why couldn't you have six or seven of these things deployed at different places, you know, in groups in different places around the world and then just... you know, set up a satellite, send up a satellite when you need it, where you need it. It could even be something that's more remote, you know, remote controlled, where you don't have all the personnel requirements and everything else. It could be very portable. I think that's one of the things that really separates us from the other groups. So you wouldn't necessarily need a hard, launch system. you could have a portable launch system or tower, even on some kind of a trailer.
Could you put it in a tube like a Stinger missile?
Yeah. Yep.
So you
yep.
could shoulder fire it. Could you shoulder yeah. fire it and live
I
through it?
Fire it.
No, the booster the booster is fairly big in this, so it's weighty, so you're not going to shoulder fire it. You're not even going to fire it from a Humvee like yeah. certain systems like they try to do, but. It's certainly a trailer pulled with a good sized truck, could launch it.
Okay. You have another caller. Hi caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, Dr. Livingston. Thanks for taking my call. This is Sean. I'm from Colorado Springs.
Okay.
And, also on vacation right now in Florida. So,
hey,
appreciate
hi,
you taking my call and, having Carl and Elise on the show. I had the pleasure also of meeting them at the Space Symposium about 4 years ago, and have really enjoyed the technical discussion and the relationship with them.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. I did have a comment with regard to a previous caller's remarks on competition. And I wanted to just comment on that a little bit, that there's a significant backlog in small satellites that are awaiting launch. And in fact, small satellites that aren't being built because there's no reliable launch system that's on demand. And I believe it wants a reliable, less expensive on-demand capability is achieved. The market's going to expand very rapidly. In fact, I would apply Ray Kurzweil's law of accelerating returns for technology to that, and say that the launches into low Earth orbit are going to grow exponentially. And just to give an example, and I really appreciate Vault's emphasis on education. Part of my background, I'm a retired Air Force guy, and part of my background was developing and implementing a space curriculum for the master's program at Air War College down in Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama. And when you look at developing curriculum for a program, what you're looking for is predictability and reliability. And when you look at a technical program, and there are many, many universities building small satellites right now, they're looking at looking for that predictability, but the timing of launches for small satellites is just way too unpredictable right now to develop that kind of curriculum. And so, you develop a course of study, then you build a satellite, and then you hope to launch it, then you hope to gather the data from it and implement that on your next launch. But all too frequently right now, the students are graduated long before the launch ever takes place, and so they never reap the benefits of that data or the learning and the technical progress that can be made from that. So I wanted to comment and say that when Vault is developed fully or when the small launch vehicles that are out there are developed fully, I don't believe there's going to be much competition. I still believe there's going to be a backlog in satellites awaiting launch. And I'm sure Elise can probably comment on that backlog and the mm-hmm. potential there is for growth, because I know she's researched that small satellite market quite a bit.
Thank you, Sean. I appreciate you calling in. Thanks a lot.
Yes.
Go ahead, Carl. Did you just want to say something?
No. I was just going to say that, I mean, it was excellent comments, because that's one of the things that, yeah, we didn't bring up is the amount of time. But, you know, I was thinking about the amount of time that it takes in the aerospace in general to actually complete a project. Hypersonics, you know, it's been even longer just because of the issue with being able to flight test. But that's definitely one of the things that we're looking at. You know, we were looking at when we were started thinking about vault, and even though it's, you know, 1.75 million per launch, as we get the frequency down and the numbers up, we anticipate with automated manufacturing practices, we could actually get that down to about 500,000 per launch, which now comes really into, you know, a much wider group of customers, because what we're asking them to do is basically purchase their own launch instead of being a ride share. So they're not riding a bus. You know, they're basically walking out into their driveway, putting their keys in their car, and they're going where they want to go. That's what we want to do.
Carl, you said the price will go up and the numbers will go down or something. You said the opposite of what you meant. You might want to clarify that the frequency will go up and the numbers will come down.
The numbers, the frequency of launches will go up so that the cost of the launch vehicle will go down as we implement automated manufacturing processes. That's what we anticipate.
We also anticipate having a far more robust suborbital market and being able to, you know, streamline a lot of the processes that are kind of, without giving away too much information, it's just the trends that I've identified. I just see that there could be a hell of a lot more coordination going on with the nanosatellite industry. It's a little bit disjointed in some ways, and I think that there's a potential, and part of our strategy is to remedy those disconnects within the industry. That there could be. Once you start dividing 1.75 by 12, and you have 12 different universities around the country, it becomes affordable to integrate the cost of launch for suborbital flight testing into the program at the academic level. And then all of a sudden, you see a far more robust suborbital economy that is supported with a lot of academic participation, And then those folks who are advancing their capabilities while in college will then become the entrepreneurs of the future, whose timelines will match up to vaults, right?
Right.
Like we'll have very fast development cycles, and that, you know, instead of their business model, like Carl mentioned and alluded to earlier or mentioned directly earlier, those business models that are currently based on existing rideshare opportunities will be able to close that gap, making them profitable in a far shorter period of time.
Yeah.
Does that kind of cover everything in a nutshell, Sean, in terms of what you were talking about?
It does, and it really gets me excited about the program as well. So I sure appreciate, again, Dr. Livingston, you having Vault on the show, because it's really a fantastic program that I'm anxious to see get off the ground and into space.
Thank you very much for
your
call,
Sean.
Thank
you.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that kind of brings me to the, you know, and I think that you mentioned it, Elise, is, you know, one of the major challenges I'm losing my train of thought here. I'm not sure why. There are definitely a bunch of different areas that we can address. Now one of the challenges is linking all those different applications and things together. But it's, you know, it's definitely there. The signs are all there that Vault can really help out in a number of different ways. And that's what we're going to try and do in a number of different areas.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to read you what may end up being the last question, but go ahead.
Sure.
Finish up.
Oh, I was just simply going to lead off of that a little tiny bit and state that we are definitely motivated, though our primary market is access to space. It is our major focus. We are not underestimating the markets at the suborbital level. You know, we're looking at missile defense applications for Vault, interceptors. There are things that there are applications that we can definitely support and are intend to do so.
that we're ideally suited for. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you for clarifying that.
This could be the last question, although I can stay longer.
Sure.
Although Carl has said he's getting hungry, so.
Oh Lord, you don't want that to happen.
We may lose him here. Listeners, if you do want to get an email in or a call in, you need to do it quickly because we will probably. This will probably be the last question unless I hear from you. But again, the number, if you want to call, is 1-866-687-7223. So Carla is in Denver, and she says, I have sort of a non-technical question for you because talking about hypersonics with the space show community is one thing, but if you went out on the street, even in a fairly well-educated area or neighborhood, and started asking people for their thoughts on hypersonic flights, I suspect you would get a lot of blank stares or WTF questions. So what do you guys do when you meet people for lunch or dinner or socially or on an airplane or just in general, and they say, what do you guys do? And you say, we work at Vault, and we're doing a lot of flight testing for hypersonics. How do you answer them, and what do you say? And do you find that people know what you're talking about, or do you have to go and act like you're a primer in kindergarten and tell them, or do you have a way to just avoid it in general?
I love that question. That's an awesome question.
Yeah,
I find it very difficult. For years, I found it very difficult to explain what technologies we develop, and I often found people looking back at me blankly, the blank stare that she refers to. And then I realized that I just needed to switch up my story and make it very simple, and explain that we're building essentially a rocket that's going to put small satellites into space, and you can, if that's as basic as it gets, right? But it could become more complicated than that very easily. So Carl, you can talk about some of the stories if you'd like, or not at length, but you can mention.
Well, are you talking to educated people? Do they know what hypersonic is? Do you avoid the term? I'm just taking Carla's question a little bit further.
Right.
You know, it's one thing if you're talking to people who don't really have an education, but if you're talking to college graduates or grad school people or someone else, it's not strange to hear the word hypersonic in the news or to see videos of Boeing tests, you know, over the Pacific Ocean. I mean, that has been on the news before and has been talked about.
Right. Sure. Yeah, if you're looking for it and you understand or want to understand what hypersonics is, but you know, we've talked to from people all different walks of life, and you have to kind of, you know, bring things down, or you can bring things up depending on, you know, what their interest level is. But I think that we're fairly down to earth, so we try and, you know, explain things very easily, just to grab them, kind of look in the eyes and see if they have that, you know, WTF look. And then, you know, kind of move on from there. But typically we'll get people that are really interested. Once you say that, hey, we're developing a launch system, they can understand the launch, you know, launch system and go into space. You know, from the space shuttle and the space programs that we've had over the years. And then you tell them that, you know, you're putting a payload that's the size of a loaf of bread. That's when they really get kind of interested. And then, you know, for the most part, you know, you can talk to them. You maybe use a lot of analogies, but you do what's needed in order to get the point across and carry on the conversation when you... When you see their eyes glaze over, then you can go off into something else.
But you don't find very many people that you meet that already are versed in these subjects,
no.
Do you?
No. No.
No.
No.
No, we don't.
And
especially, you
and
know...
I was just going to say, I just think it's a lot easier to say rocket. You know, once we start talking about hypersonics, it gets hairy. You know, and even
what is
air breathing propulsion? Then you, they just spin at the first sentence. So you just need to drop that from the conversation.
Yeah, you got to say jet.
You don't know where they're coming from.
What is scary about hypersonics?
I think it's exciting. I don't know about scary.
No, didn't you say it gets scary if you mention the word?
Oh, scary meaning that's immediately when people shut down. They're like, what? You know, it's spinning. So I try to not.
Doesn't bode well for our technology education in this country, does
well,
it?
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Good comment, by the way.
Yeah, it's really fascinating history though, and hypersonics.
Well, yeah, of course.
It's been around for a long time, and all one has to do is kind of the company that I first started out working for, General Applied Science Laboratories, or GASL. Which is owned by ATK now, but it was privately held when I started working there. It was started by an Italian scientist that was brought over here to the U.S. during World War II from Italy, a guy by the name of Antonio Ferri. And the history, what he went through and the stuff that he was doing in his laboratory over at a university in Italy is just fascinating. And the Secret Service or the spy, I should say, that brought him over, Mo Berg, which there's a movie about him. It's very interesting history, and even the NAS program has some really interesting history. Unfortunately, the program, never really got off the ground, so to speak, but it was around for a long time, and there were a lot of good things done, a lot of good people that actually left, the area because field because they had to. I mean, it just wasn't paying anymore. But, now hypersonics comes back into the picture a lot more just because of the threats, technology development in different areas. And most of it's focused in on, weapons or that kind of thing. We want to push it, back towards space. I mean, even if you're launching a rocket and you're going into orbit, if you're going into hypersonic speeds above Mach 5, which you will, it's hypersonic. So there's a bunch of different areas in it. I think it's very fascinating. It's a matter of trying to make it fascinating to whoever it is that you're telling the story to. But it's got a rich history. The perception just has to change. But I think it's going to here soon.
We are at the end of the program. Is there anything I should have asked you about that I've omitted or I've forgotten or didn't know to ask you or that you want to add or say?
Well, for me, I guess I'll start off. One of the things that I wanted to make clear is in the, vault is we're really looking at lowering the cost of the total launch vehicle. And Jody had brought up the question about the cost per unit weight figure of merit that's typically used in the launch industry. It doesn't work for the nanosatellite, at least if you're going to give the customer a when and where into orbit capability, they have to buy the whole launch vehicle. So that's what is going to count. And we aim to make that as cheap as possible in terms of cost of the whole vehicle, not necessarily the cost per unit weight.
Okay. Elise, you have any final comments or something that we should have talked about or have omitted or forgotten?
No, I don't. I think I'm pretty comfortable with what we discussed in the course of this conversation, and I really want to thank you for allowing us this opportunity to appear on your show, so to speak, quote unquote.
Thank you
so much.
Are you guys headed for any public appearances, conferences, or anything where people can catch up with you?
That is coming up for sure. We were there every year, and we're looking forward to attending that this year. And we have a pretty hefty schedule of conferences that we intend to be attending in the year coming ahead. So,
any chance you'll be in Orlando in September for the Space 2017 meeting at AIAA?
I'll have to look at that on the schedule and see if that's even feasible for us to achieve, Carl. We're in the process of ramping up, so we're ex- this the next 3 months are going to be extraordinarily busy for us. 6 months, and then it's going to get busier. However, the busier Carl gets, the more people I have, right? So then I can be in a lot of different places.
If you do go to Orlando for AIAA, let me know. I'm planning to be down there, and it would be great to catch up with you guys again.
Would love to see you. Thank you so much again.
Yes, where do
you do your flight test in Maine? I forgot to ask you that.
That's one thing I did. Yes, we conduct right now all of our flight testing in Maine because we've got a very low population density up here. We've got all the GPS we need in the system, so it's easy enough for us to track things down. Plus, we recover everything. We have recovery systems and everything. So, I mean, first stage is reusable, always. Second stage, maybe. Third stage, likely not. Because of the safety aspects of Vault, it being so small and the lack of oxygen, that we have on board, we may even be able to launch from the state of Maine. We'd have the only direct polar orbit, the only direct access to polar orbit on the East Coast. So it's something that we're looking forward to. If we can bring launch to New England, that's what we want to do.
So you're trying to get a spaceport approved for vertical launch in Maine.
That is the goal. That is absolutely what we're headed for.
Okay.
Yep.
So, and also, right now, you said where specifically? We're in Mid-Coast Maine region, where we're launching from.
Okay.
It's where the Tripoli group has been launching for years in Maine. And so we're taking advantage of the airspace in Maine, and it's also enabling us to, like Carl said, keep costs very low for us, which was the goal from Jump, you know, so with this platform. So we're excited. We're probably going to tap into – we're headed to Loring. We're hoping to launch, you know, near Loring as we mature as a vehicle, as we go up through the three iterations of Vault in terms of size and scale. And then we'll be launching off of the coast in northern Maine and staging our system hopefully at Loring Air Force Base. Should we gain the support of Maine senators and our governor, and should everything move smoothly regulatorily speaking? I don't even think that's a word. Regulation-wise, how's that work?
It'll work.
It's the end of the day, clearly.
Yeah. Loring is in northern Maine, and the Air Force had a big SAC base there that was shut down during BRAC. So the folks up in northern Maine are very eager for this program, and they look forward to our launches up there.
All right, guys, I know you need food, so
thank you so much. As you do as well.
I'm off to a dog walk. I'm gonna go out and get some exercise. I want to thank you both for being on the show. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to staying in touch with you and talking to you some more as you develop Vault and you keep going down the road to hypersonics and what you're doing. So thank you again.
Great.
And
thank you very much, David.
Okay, and listeners, thank you for emailing and calling. We appreciate that. Tomorrow night, the Lunar Plans with AJ. You can see his presentation on the blog for his show tomorrow night, Kathari, Dr. Kathari. And then Wednesday is Planetary Defense with John Batchelor and Hotel Mars. And then back Friday and Sunday is Open Lines. Actually, there is no show on Friday because we're doing a special show on Thursday night, July 20th, with Rand Simberg and Bill Simon on the new version of Evo Laterra. So all of you who want to commemorate July 20th, which deserves to be commemorated, tune in Thursday, no show Friday, back Sunday with Open Lines. Everybody have a great week. Thanks to our guest. Goodbye from the Space
Have
Show.
Have a great night.
Keep looking up, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.